This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the space in the metaverse where you, me, the top experts, and a big subject get together for 28 minutes. This week, in October, the UK lost 417,000 working days due to labour strikes, the highest number for more than 10 years. Numbers for November and December aren't going to make pretty reading either. Is Britain heading back to the turbulent 70s? Double-digit inflation driven in part by energy price shocks, another interest rate rise and strikes seemingly everywhere. It's winter and there's a lot of discontent. People are saying it's the 70s revisited. But is it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we love a history lesson on this show. So, how significant were the strikes of the 70s? How important were the unions? And what did Margaret Thatcher's government do about it? Joining me in the briefing room is Keith Laybourne, Professor of History at the University of Huddersfield. Keith Laybourne, take me back to the 1970s. Back then, how significant a force were the trade unions?
Well, at that stage, the trade unions were probably at their height. They had, by the end of the 70s, more than 13 million members, twice the number they've got now, which was about, at that time, about 45% of the workforce. So it's pretty substantial.
How easy was it to call a strike if you were at a union?
In the 70s, basically, most strikes were unofficial. After 2,000 strikes, perhaps 1,700 or 1,800 were unofficial. People just went out. For the official strikes, all you needed was a meeting, effectively. The rules would change from union to union.
I remember television pictures where strikes effectively would be voted on by a show of hands.
Yes, show of hands. But the unions actually were pretty successful, and there are two or three examples of that particularly. One is in 1972, there was the miners' strike, which was successful in getting wage increase, the first official strike by miners since the general strike of 1926. In the end of 73-74, there was another miners' strike, which, of course, led to the three-day week. And the three-day week, those who lived through it can remember it, the only electricity and run for that period. And that forced, really, Edward Heath into a general election, which he lost, and the Labour Party came to power. So they were successful in getting those.
You talked about the size of the trade union membership. Were private and public sectors equally unionised?
I think the private probably more than the public, but both were strongly unionised. You almost have it the other way around now. And so they were powerfully organised. As I said, you know, 45%, so not a majority of workers, but a significant proportion were unionised at that time.
And was it fair to say that, by and large, the sectors that were unionised were the sectors that were able to get the biggest pay increases for their members?
Undoubtedly so. Your miners, who are unionised, your rail workers are unionised, some of the municipal workers, yes.
What did the Labour government try to do in that period in order to try and contain and deal with the trade unions?
Yeah. Well, the trade union movement was powerful. It had established its authority not simply in industrial relations terms, but it worked through, as from the Second World War indeed, worked through joint committees, and therefore it had a stake in determining the economic growth of Britain, equal to the businessmen, equal to management, equal to government, and so forth. And of course, the trade unions had influence through NEDI, National Economic Development Council, where they had status and influence, etc. When Labour came in 1974 again, its purpose really was to try to regulate wage increases because of inflation. And what happened is that they worked an arrangement with the trade unions through the TUC, through the Trade Union Congress, which created a social contract, was the phrase that was used. And the social contract is that trade unions would moderate their wage increases to 3, 4%, whatever, in return for the government providing extra money for social care and social activities. Well, that all came to an end in 1976, where the International Monetary Fund, the Labour government had to go to it to get £1 billion and backup money as well. And therefore, the demands of the IMF meant they couldn't spend that money. So the trade unions felt frustrated. Really, the 78-79 winter of discontent reflects that frustration. Rising inflation, increasing demands, and you got, for instance, the Ford workers were first out. They wanted a 25% increase if you included the hours reduction. They got 16. That was in August, September, October 1978. That was followed by rail workers who in January 1979 had 4 days of action. It was followed famously by municipal workers who on the 22nd of January 1979 came out. And of course, it led to gravediggers in Liverpool, the famous example of not burying the dead. And one councillor at Liverpool made that comment, we'll have to bury them at sea. So the Sun and the other newspapers take that up, burial at sea. And that whole conflict, in which most trade unions got something out of it, led ultimately to a general election in which, of course, James Callaghan lost it and Margaret Thatcher came in.
Now, when Thatcher became PM in 79, part of her political mandate was to tackle the unions. How did she go about it?
Well, Margaret Thatcher was very much influenced to begin with by a section of the Conservative Party called the Bow Group. And the Bow Group in the 1970s produced pamphlets attacking strikes and attacking the miners, and in a sense almost wanting revenge for the success of the miners in 72 and 74. And her first idea, because she was a monetarist, is that trade unions have no place in determining wages or anything else. And
Because the market should do it.
The market should do it, exactly. Monetarism. You know, monetarism says business. And therefore, there's no place for trade unions, wage, taxes, whatever, and indeed democracy. But anyway, that's another matter. But can I just say that what she decided to do was to control the trade unions. And she and John Major, because he succeeded her, introduced between them, I think it was 8 acts, a Public Order Act and one or two others, but I think it was 5 Employment Acts and 1 Trade Union Act. And I will not try to separate those out because they become fairly complex, but the gist of it was to stop the closed shop. Now, the closed shop is, if you wanted to go into a particular employment, the union had control and you had to be a member of the union to take that job up. She wanted to, well, force unions to take votes before they could take strike action. And there were lots of other pieces of legislation connected with that. And really what she did was to destroy, in a sense, the power base of the unions. They couldn't freely do what they wished to do, or at least the leadership couldn't. The miners' strike, of course, is the last really big strike which tried to resist these changes that were going on.
Keith Laybourne, what about today's unions and the constraints they operate under? Alex Bryson is Professor of Quantitative Social Science at UCL's Social Research Institute. Alex Bryson, we heard from Patrick Laybourne just now that in the late 70s, union membership was around 13 million and was distributed across both the private and the public sectors. What is it now?
As of 2021, 6.4 million workers, and that constitutes about 23% of employees in employment. It's been actually rising a tiny bit in the last couple of years, but actually fell last year by about 60,000.
How does the wave of strikes we're experiencing this month differ from those we saw in the 1970s?
Well, first of all, even though it feels big, it's nowhere near as big as the peaks of the 70s and 80s. So back in 1972, there was a coal miners' strike, which lost us 24 million working days. In the winter of discontent in 1979, we saw the loss of 29.5 million days. In the miners' strike, 1984, 27 million days lost. Today, we're talking maybe a couple of million days lost at the most. Yes, this feels big because it's the biggest spike in strike action for over a decade, but it's nowhere near as big as those previous occurrences. And one of the main reasons for that is the strike activity is a little bit more sporadic today. And I think that's a tactical thing. We don't see the rail workers, for example, going out for weeks on end. They're able to achieve their bargaining objective, disrupting services, by going out for an odd day here and there.
What that suggests is that the unions have adapted their tactics to deal with legislation that past governments have passed on regulating strike action.
Well, they absolutely have to be cognizant of the legislation, much of which came in the 1980s, but has continued right through to actually 2016, such that by that point, trade unions had to not only ensure that at least half of the members in a bargaining unit were voting, but that over half of those that did vote voted for strike action. And this is a very serious set of concerns for trade unions because they can be held legally liable for official strike action or action short of a strike if they don't follow all the legal requirements. In the worst case scenario, they can have their funds sequestrated, as indeed happened to the miners back in the 1980s.
I was wondering whether or not also the needs to meet the legal requirements has altered the way in which they approach the question of settlement.
It does give them some degree of legitimacy and credibility at the bargaining table when they do eventually sit down with an employer and say, there we are, look what our members are feeling. Think of this in terms of the nurses at the moment. This is the first national strike in England for many long time for nurses. And at one level, they can say, look, we've got this massive support amongst our members. This is how serious the situation is. What are you going to do about it?
So there's government legislation has actually helped the unions because it's forced them to gain real legitimacy for their strike action.
I think many trade unions would not see it like that, but certainly that is one way of seeing things, yes.
Somebody is going to lose out somewhere because employees are not being paid for that period. How are these people compensated? Do they still get strike pay?
So most trade unions do have strike pay funds, and those strike funds don't go very far. It nowhere near replaces their wages. As a consequence, they do suffer severe financial hardship, or they could do, and that's not sustainable for a long period of time. That's not the only hardship, of course. You could lose your job. It's possible, actually, for an employer to dismiss you after a certain initial period, I think 12 weeks. So essentially, although people talk about a right to strike, there isn't really one in Britain.
Let's look at public support. How is public support or opposition to the strikes going?
Generally speaking, it would appear, whether we're talking train drivers or nurses, there's a fairly strong degree of support for their actions. More broadly, however, there's a very interesting set of numbers I looked at this morning on questions in public attitude surveys about whether unions have too much power. Back in the late 1970s, this Ipsos study was suggesting around 4/5 of individuals in Britain felt that. By 2017, that had gone down to 1/3. The same people asked a different question: are unions essential to protect workers' interests? Again, the same number in 1979, 80%. Are they still essential in 2020? Again, 80%.
So the headline on that is people think that trade unions are much less powerful, but the same number of people, which is a lot, think that they're essential to protect workers. Let's look at where that leaves the government and its current policy, which seems to be, for the most part, it's not our job to intervene. The exception, of course, is in Scotland, where the Scottish government has intervened. Is that a fair assessment that I've just made of their strategy?
It would seem to be based upon public pronouncements. We have to remember that we are not privy to what goes on behind the scenes, the back channeling. They don't want to engage in that negotiation on the public airwaves and reveal their cards to the public. So it's possible that other things are going on at the moment, but I haven't really got much of a sniff of that. I would expect at this juncture that they would bring in the Advisory Conciliation and Arbitration Service, ACAS, or an independent entity set up under statute who are experts in mediating between disputing parties when there has been a protracted dispute.
Seriously, Alex, I haven't heard the term ACAS used for years. I thought it had probably been disbanded. It's still there.
It's still there. And actually, last year, I think they did exactly this in roughly 500 or 600 disputes. Government wanted that dispute to be dealt with quickly. I think they would be resorting to ACAS by now. There aren't that many other things that the employer can do.
Alex Bryson. The strikes clearly create big political problems for the government. But what big economic problems do they cause, if any? Joining me now in the briefing room are Gemma Tetlow, Chief Economist at the Institute for Government, and Chris Giles, Economics Editor at the Financial Times. Gemma Tetlow, the purpose of this programme in many ways is to examine what's different and what's similar between now and the 70s. Is the economic situation in the UK today, would you say, similar to that of the 70s?
There are certainly some apparent headline similarities between what's going on now and what happened in the 1970s. In particular, the fact that we've got double-digit inflation and that's being driven in large part by energy price shock. And the result of that is that for macro policy, again, as we had in the 70s, some of the trade-offs become much tougher. That we've got the Bank of England, for example, having to think about raising interest rates to try and bring inflation down precisely at the time when we're going into or sort of risking the impact that that might have on pushing the economy into recession and pushing up unemployment. But there are certainly some important differences between now and the 1970s. And in terms of the impact of high energy prices on the UK economy, the production in the UK is much less energy intensive than it was in the 1970s. So actually high energy prices don't have quite the impact on our production costs that they did. Conversely, energy is still a big part of what households buy. And so we're actually now seeing households face a bigger hit relative to the hit that we're seeing to production in the economy now than would have been the case in the 1970s. But also certainly in terms of thinking about what the implications are for wage setting and risks around how wages feed back into inflation. One of the important differences now is that people are much less likely to be a member of a trade union. So the role of trade unions in collective bargaining and wage setting is much less important now than it was in the 1970s.
Chris, do you broadly agree?
I broadly agree entirely. We've got double-digit inflation. We've got some strikes. And Britain seems sicker as an economy than other parts of the advanced world. Growth is actually slower than in the 70s now, but one of the important differences and makes the trade-off that Gemma was talking about between inflation and a likely recession even harder is that unemployment is low. So the impetus for people to ask for high wages rather than from unions, it comes from the fact that unemployment is low, vacancies are high. So in the private sector, at least, people have other options than necessary to stay with their current employer.
Right. Well, that takes me right to the heart of what seems to be a debate. And the government is saying that giving large pay increases, though actually they seem to be below the current rate of inflation on the whole, is itself inflationary and therefore can't be allowed because of all the terrible consequences that will flow. And it seems to me that there are two schools of thought about this. Quite a lot of serious experts, academics say increasing public sector wages will fuel inflation. And quite a few say that isn't the case. I'm going to ask you both to set out the pros and cons of the two respective positions, starting with you, Gemma.
To start with the sort of the theory of why this might be a problem, the idea here is in the private sector, the mechanism that people have in mind is that inflation is high, workers demand large pay increases to compensate them for those higher costs of living. Their employers, if they meet those wage demands, then have to put up their prices in turn to try and cover those costs. And so you get a feedback loop from higher wages leading to higher prices by employers. And so in turn, workers demand higher wages again. as Chris said, the mechanism by which this might happen now is rather different from the 1970s. In the 1970s, it was much more about collective bargaining from unions, unions demanding high pay settlements in response to high inflation. Now, as Chris said, we don't have that sort of collective bargaining. So the way that this could happen would be that workers can go and look for jobs elsewhere, find a higher pay offer somewhere else, and either switch jobs and get that higher pay offer or use that as leverage to encourage their employer to pay them more. In the public sector, it's a sort of much more remote mechanism that would be in place because obviously the public sector doesn't sell things at any price, so there's not a direct feedback from wages into price setting. So it would be some more indirect mechanism of high pay settlements in the public sector, then feeding back through to higher wage demands in the private sector. My take on the evidence at the moment is there's not much evidence that there is much danger of that, certainly at the levels of pay setting that we're talking about. So private sector wages are, wage growth is running at about 7% a year, which, as you say, is below headline inflation at the moment. And most of the pay settlements that have recently been agreed in the public sector are below that again. So I think it's a stretch to think that there's a big risk at the moment of this wage price spiral starting to get out of control.
And Chris, your take?
I think I broadly agree with Gemma. Where I would say there's more of a risk of a wage price spiral, albeit a modest one, is in the private sector, where private sector wage growth of 7% roughly, which looks likely to stay at that sort of level, ultimately is not consistent with inflation of 2%. So I think it's legitimate for the Bank of England, for example, to be concerned that private sector wages are rising too fast, even though they are below inflation levels. So that is what the Bank of England is wanting to see come down, because if private sector wages keep rising at 7% or so, then ultimately companies will have to keep raising prices more than 2%. It doesn't mean they have to raise prices at 7%, because there'll be some productivity gains, hopefully, but it does mean it's unlikely that productivity being strong enough that price rises would only be 2%, which is the Bank of England's target. So that's what they're worried about. In the public sector, the question is always about how much more money would the government be putting into the economy as a whole. And so if public sector wages rose very quickly, let's say in line with inflation, that would, if nothing else changed, put more money into the economy, people would spend more, and that ultimately would raise inflationary pressures, although not by very much. But the question is, other things aren't ultimately equal, so the government could either tax more to pay for the higher public sector wages, in which case no more money goes into the economy, and as Gemma said, there are no prices that directly are related to government services or public services. Or the Bank of England could raise interest rates more to take money out of the economy in other ways so that there was no inflationary impetus or no inflationary effect of higher public sector wages. But that requires other things to happen.
So this rather baffles me in a way, because none of what either of you have said suggests that public sector wage increases would feed directly into an inflationary spiral. And yet that seems to be what the government's saying. And in addition to that, what the government seems to be saying on the back of it, if you interpret it, is we're effectively running an old-fashioned incomes policy in the public sector as a consequence of this argument. Gemma?
It does seem a bit strange for the government to put so much emphasis on the role of public sector pay settlements in driving or mitigating inflationary pressures. Because as Chris said, we have a macro policy tool for controlling inflation, which is monetary policy. And so to the extent that the Bank of England still has scope to raise interest rates and cut back on quantitative easing and other monetary policy tools, public sector pay isn't necessarily the most obvious tool for controlling inflation. I think it's interesting looking back at some of the reports that came out from the public sector pay review bodies over the summer, that they all have in their remits, in one way or another, the requirement to have regard to the government's inflation target. And they quite explicitly suggested in their sort of findings and recommendations that actually their view was that anything they did on pay for their remit body wouldn't be a big factor in driving inflation outside of sort of other more direct underlying influences of inflation.
Well, that strikes me as being really important in the argument. Chris, could you possibly just explain for people who don't know, since a lot of talk has been made about independent pay review bodies, who actually sits on them and how do they come up with the recommended figure?
The independent pay review bodies are essentially staffed by experts, the great and the good. They're people who really do have quite a lot of experience in understanding how pay affects both recruitment and retention in the services and how that might have wider implications for the economy as a whole. But the key thing is then they're independent only to a certain extent. They're independent but have a remit which is set by government. So, for example, the teachers' independent pay review body has to make sure that its proposals are affordable. That's a direct quote from its remit. For nurses, the pay review body has to take into account the funds available to health departments. So they're only independent up to a point, and that point includes how much money the government has to spend or has put in place to spend. So they're not independent of ministers' wishes or the Treasury's spending review settlements. And so in that sense, when ministers say they're entirely independent and entirely just say an amount that is entirely right for the services and don't take other things into account, that actually isn't strictly or isn't at all true, because they have to take into account affordability. And that means they're taking into account how much the government has set and put into budgets in the first place.
Chris, some of the pay deals proposed by employers have come, I'm thinking particularly of railways, with changes in conditions attached. And reform is a word commonly used by the government. That, of course, has nothing to do with inflation at all, does it?
No, and it clearly complicates matters, because there are two things going on, particularly in the rail dispute. One is a pay dispute, which is simply about inflation and to what extent are railway workers going to be compensated for cost of living increases. And secondly, there are important changes that management want to make in the contractual terms of railway workers. And in lots of ways, the people in the RMT are more concerned about job security, or how they would put it, safety on the railways, than pay, or at least as much concerned about this. And there are sort of big quality of life issues about working on the railways in terms of rostering, rotors, how much weekend working, and all of those sorts of issues, which are very important in an employment contract, but are getting mixed up in this whole dispute about pay. So it's about two things. It's about pay and the terms and conditions of service at the same time.
I'm going to put that unpopular last question to you. Let's imagine the extraordinary has happened and the studio walls here have dissolved and we're suddenly in a room in number 10 and I am transmogrified into the Prime Minister and I say, guys, what should I do? What do you say?
I say that in the end, you are going to have to give in some sense, to the public sector workers. I would have thought the best thing to do would be to try and enforce the 2022 pay increase, but with a promise for more pay in 2023, because inflation is clearly higher and public sector wages are clearly running well below the private sector's. So in the end, the government is not going to be able to hold the line, because if it tries to do that, in the end, the service quality of the public services will fall quite severely if they don't pay more.
Chris Giles there with Gemma Tetlow. My thanks to them and to Keith Laybourne and Alex Bryson. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Simon Watts, and the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to the entire back catalogue, including the one on what's behind the protests and dissent against Xi Jinping, the one about whether Vladimir Putin might use nuclear weapons, and the one about how the UK is getting on at negotiating free trade deals.
Hello, it's Chris Van Tulliken here. My brother Zand.
That's me. I'm here too.
And I are back.
Now, in series two of our Radio 4 podcast, A Thorough Examination, we are on a mission to find out whether or not people can change.
It's called Can I Change? We're thinking about all the things we want to change about ourselves and each other.
Wait, what?
I want to be more confident.
I'd like to be less of a people pleaser.
I'd like to be more of an extrovert, but then sometimes I also think I should shut up.
A quiet, confident man. That's very attractive.
Yeah, I'd like a quiet confidence.
I think everyone has something they'd like to change about themselves.
Change is important to me because I think it's going to improve the key relationships in my life, and one of those is you, Zand.
You can change whatever you like, just don't make me do it again.
Well, nonetheless, Zand, we are going to speak to some experts who are going to guide us through the idea of change.
The last time you made me do this, it changed my life for the better.
Yeah.
But I still don't want to do it.
And if you at home think there's something stuck in your life that needs changing, this might be helpful for you too. Search for A Thorough Examination with Drs. Chris
and Zand
on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.